morning, folks. My name's Manny, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
I have a tendency of being a little bit tone deaf or something. I got your name as being Hamlet?
Close.
Hamnet. Hamnet.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought Hamlet. Gee whiz, I said, that's pretty cool. And I've got 2 gigs here, so that's 16 hours of speaking time. In case anybody doesn't know, I can speak for 16 hours here. So rest, sit back, relax, enjoy. It's going to be a long show. Like I said, I'm Manny and I'm an alcoholic. And where to begin? I'm not going to go through a long drunkalogue. I'm sure everybody in here knows and has the capacity to drink and knows how to drink. And by the way, George, 4 times. So 2 is good. You're doing well. My sobriety date's July 3rd, 1993. I came into these rooms July of 92, actually. It was a long journey. I started, I don't want to go to the beginning, but I guess I'll qualify. I started drinking alcoholically. I would say I drank about 15 years. Alcohol was my substance of choice. This is what I chose. Although there are a lot of drugs in my story, I would never have touched a drug in my life had it not been for an alcohol beverage in front of me. Never. I would have calmed down and not touched anything. So once I take alcohol, for me, the way I see it is as soon as alcohol for me was like a gateway. Other people use pot for a gateway or whatever. For me, alcohol was. I was a shy, terrified, introverted little kid. I don't know why I was so fearful, but my disease is fear. My serious disease was fear at that time growing up. So the minute I drank some alcohol, immediately I gained this liquid courage. This liquid courage allowed catapulted me into this disorder, into this disease. It was not pot or anything like that. Pot made me more fearful. If anybody, the worst thing that I could do was smoke a joint. As soon as I'd smoke a joint, I'd hide in a closet. I was paranoid, instant paranoia. So it didn't take very long for me to start smoking joints and stop, in other words. It was easy to stop. The alcohol, however, was always there, always ever present. And there was a lot of insanity in my life. I was quite a disruptive kid. I have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. I'm a hyperactive kid, and I didn't take very well to listening to teachers, authority figures, or anything like that. So there was a lot of trouble, a lot of insanity in my life as I was a kid. I was constantly in trouble. It never ended, and that's pretty weird for a quiet kid who's terrified and doesn't want any attention to be the center of attention continuously. So I was constantly terrified. My disease is crippling fear. I'm telling you, I remember my grade 2 teacher telling me to stand up, and I was in love with her. I think I was in love with her in grade 2. She told me to stand up and read this little thing. I stood up, I started to read it, and turned so pale and started to drip sweat in grade 2. And I was so terrified that she felt bad for me, I guess, because I saw the pain in her face. And she let me sit down, and I think I was quiet the rest of the year, and I passed. I did everything so perfect so that she can never, ever say, Manny, can you come to the front? You've made a mistake. Everything I ever did was perfect. She told my parents they have a brilliant child, a prodigy, because I was so good in school, just to make sure that she never, never pointed me out again in grade 2. It was a nightmare. It was a literal nightmare, I have to admit. So I was kind of an alcoholic ready to happen, waiting to happen. I believe it's a genetic disorder. There is a genetic factor to alcoholism as far as I'm concerned. I also studied it, and they found, at least in the Center for Behavioral Neurobiology, they found that 30% is genetic and 70% is environment. So I believe that I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. My grandfather died at the age of 30 years old back in the old country on the moonshine he used to make. Back then, every time you died or anybody died, it used to be pneumonia. That was it. Everybody died of pneumonia, plain and simple. What it was, nobody knew, but it was pneumonia. You know, and that's what he had. But he used to walk around with a gallon of this moonshine on his shoulders, and it never left him, ever. And he died just before the war. World War II, that is. Let's not go all the way back to the Spartans or something. Anyway, like I said, so there was a lot of unruliness, so to speak, civil disobedience. How's that? When I was a kid. And coming from an ethnic European background, the way my family solved problems was to send you to a relative. They sent you to a relative to solve the problem, and my family happened to send me to an alcoholic relative. So we had a ball. And he would call them and tell them, oh no, man, he's doing so well. He has a six-pack at night and goes to sleep. He couldn't ask for a better thing than that because he was drinking Chivas Regal. He was a drummer in a band that night, and I was waiting on tables. So this is what I ended up doing. I ended up drinking from the six-pack, but what happened is I would drink a six-pack before and a six-pack after, hidden in my room, which he didn't know about, until eventually we got together and we started to split his Chivas and my beer back and forth. So it was Scotch and beer chasers. And that was the beginning of kind of a geographical cure. That was around the age of 14, 15 years old, and that was in Texas. And I had done extremely well in school. And my the ninth year of my school, grade 9, secondary 2, I guess today, sec 2 or sec 3, whatever it's called, I just twisted aside. I twisted away. I lost that fear because I found alcohol. And my whole life just changed completely. Where I believe I was going for a specific destiny, I just hit a fork in the road that took me to places. I'm not going to sit here and discuss with you all night long. It could be a very, very long story, and this thing may not even hold the memory. But I did go to Texas, Florida, Arizona, Chicago, and I landed in New York City, March 17th, 1982. March 16th, 1982. March 16th is the day before St. Patrick's Day. And my cousin over there ran the food carts that sell hot dogs and pretzels on the street corners of Manhattan. I went inside the shop when I got out of the airport. My godfather had brought me over to my cousin's place. I went inside the shop. They said, welcome. I passed by to say hello and come back home. I was coming back to Montreal because I'd spent close to 20 years in the States. I was basically raised there. And I was going to say hello to them all before I came back to Montreal. When my cousin, I guess they had spoken to my family or relatives or something. There was always a grapevine of things that were going on in everybody's life story. So they saw me come in, and as I started to speak to my cousin George, downstairs in the basement of this garage where he had all these carts, he also had a little office kind of bureau, so to speak, government bureau. They took a picture, fixed the license for me, and I was automatic. I was never legally in the United States. I still don't have legal papers. My parents are American. I'm not. I had never went for my papers. I was too drunk. I spent 10 years in New York City. I've never been to the Statue of Liberty, the Lincoln Center, Museum of Fine Arts. I've been around them in the dark, in the back alleys. I've been all over them. I never actually went in to see a museum exhibit of any sort. The only thing I did in 10 years in Manhattan, which I can remember because the 80s to me are basically a blackout, the entire decade. So what I can remember is that this guy between the 86th and 102nd floor in the Empire State Building liked to drink ouzo, this Greek drink. Him and I used to get wasted, and he told me, the higher we go, the higher we get. I said, so step on it. And up there they have these windows that you can't punch your way out of just in case you want to commit suicide. I mean, that's the only place I went in Manhattan in 10 years. I've got to go back there as a tourist even to this day. I still have yet to go. I don't know anything about Manhattan. But I worked there for 10 years, and I saw everything. And I went into Manhattan thinking that I was a wise guy. I knew my way around. I used to say to myself and tell other people, if you can pick me up and throw me in the middle of China, right in the rice fields. You're going to find me the owner of a land, rice paddies, and me and my Chinese employees, we're going to be at the cafe. And I would get by no matter where you threw me. After having gone around the States in many, many funny ways. Anyway, the way I did drink didn't suit the Manhattan lifestyle. When I started to drink, after my first drink, I would fall into blackouts. I'm a blackout drinker from day one. From the day I can remember, I was a blackout drinker. People had to tell me the day after exactly what I had done. And that was beginning to get embarrassing and scary at the same time, because I didn't know. I have a couple of bumps and bruises on my head. I don't know where I got them. The only thing I can remember in my drinking time was one time in Manhattan, I was taking a drink somewhere. I walked into a bar on 4th Street, which is right beside NYU in Greenwich Village. And then I was rolling down 4th Street, rolling, literally, head first and going round and around like a kid. And I woke up, as I was rolling, I woke up out of a blackout. A car could have easily ran me over. But I know it was... I looked around because I was in the middle of the street and there was 1, 2, 3, 4 bars. I didn't know which one. I kind of figured they bounced me out of one of these bars. How they did it and who did it, I'm not sure. But I was rolling this way, must have been that bar, but I'm not sure. Therefore, all 4 of these bars are out of the question. I can't go back. Can't go back in any of them because I didn't know what I had done. I had a big mouth. There's no doubt about it. I'm sure if I continued drinking, somebody would have shot me, killed me, or I would have killed somebody myself. Because there was a time in New York that I carried a weapon too, and everybody does there. It's just part of life. And I don't know why I never did anything like that, thank God, because it's really not my nature to do that kind of stuff. But alcohol brought me to places that I could never, never, never imagine. I have a lot of funny stories, a lot of sad stories. But I'll tell you what, none of those stories are Manny's stories. None of those stories are me. The real me stands before you tonight. That person back there was left back there. He's gone. It's been, I'm going to be 15 years this year. I can barely identify with the person I used to be. I have a difficult time trying to spill out my story. I've lost a lot of the details. I really don't remember what I had done. And a lot of the things that I was always in a blackout too at the same time. And a lot of that stuff never came back. I know I did some kind of damage to my memory because I have a hard time retaining information to this day, forming new memories. I know I drank myself to death. That also includes the tons and tons of drugs I did too. It never stopped because when I discovered cocaine, I realized I can drink 100 times more, not just for the night. So I did as much of that stuff as I could in order to maintain my drinking. I could go for weeks. I would drink and party, go to work the next morning. I never missed a day of work. When I was a kid, my mother told me, because I was hanging around with a very rough crowd, and all of them, we were just out of high school, and all of them were going in and out of the juvenile detention centers. So I got put away in a juvenile detention center for 2 weeks once. And that the judge had told me was to teach me a lesson because I had done nothing wrong, really bad. But he says he's going to teach me a lesson, and boy, he taught me a lesson. Let me tell you, 2 weeks, the center was St. Vallier and then Berthelet. Anyway, I don't even know if they exist anymore. Well, my mother told me, I'm going to let you rot there. No visits, no nothing, no cigarettes, not 10 cents, no canteen. You're going to die in there. We're going to leave you there to die. It terrified me. I had no visits, no nothing for the 2 weeks I was there. Went like 2 years. I didn't sleep for the 2 weeks I was there. I met a few people. I saw a couple of people burning shoe polish and drinking it. Somebody offered me a little sip of Aqua Velva and I took it. I belched that stuff out even to this day, man. Aqua Velva. I drank Aqua Velva, man. How could I drink Aqua Velva? But I did. I did. A little sip of it. I didn't enjoy the prison life. So automatically, I focused my energy on working. And I'm a workaholic. If you let me go, I'll work myself to death. I have to catch myself, stop myself, and take a little vacation, or I'll work to death. So whatever I did throughout my life, I always carried a job. I always held a job. Never did I have a day without a job. If I didn't have a job for one day, the next day I got one. So as I did all my partying and all my drinking and all those blackouts, I would go to work the next day not remembering where I was the night before. People would tell me, what did you do last night? Make up all kinds of stories. I had no idea what I had done. So, back to where was I? In Manhattan. Manhattan, that was a very, very dangerous place. I'm very surprised. One thing about Manhattan is that if you go over there thinking you're tough, you're going to find somebody tougher. If you go there thinking you're crazy, you're going to find somebody crazier. If you go there thinking you're smart, you're going to find somebody smarter. This is a city that has everything. Every single thing you can possibly imagine, and then some new ideas too. So I soon learned that it takes experience to live in Manhattan, because it goes streets, avenues, tic-tac-toe. And one street is safe, and it's a very classy, ritzy street. The street over is the ghetto. You have to know what you're doing. Otherwise, you walk, weave and bob in Manhattan, and you're finished. You're a goner. I lived in this house. People got to know me there. When you start to live there and you become a native, people get to know you, you know. And I was pretty safe over there for me. Having a name like Emmanuel, I sounded like a Puerto Rican. Manuel, coming down the street with a little bit of a tan. Puerto Rican, he's one of us, Latino. And I got through it. I don't know how I did, but I got through it. However, in 1990, I started to realize that I was seriously ill. It was not a very good thing. I was realizing I was working to party. We made mountains of money. Everything I ever touched turned to gold. I've never been in any kind of business or any job that I didn't make major money. I did very, very well. Very well. Actually, my cousin is he's richer than God, this guy. And my godfather built a massive hotel on a Mediterranean island. I had cigarettes, a pack of cigarettes. That's all I had, man. Out of all that stuff, we made mountains, dump trucks of money. In the village, we were pioneers. We were there for 10 years. Nobody else had ever gone there. So we were the only ones there. I mean, we were busy from morning to night. We made so much money, it was incredible. And I came back from Manhattan in 1991. I think I came back to Montreal because I was beaten. I was unable to get up in the mornings and continue doing what I was doing. I was already beaten. I was about 30 years old. I was beaten. I was measuring these hangovers with the Richter scale. I said, this is a 7.5. And I had never experienced a hangover before that. First of all, I used to go straight from partying to work. I never slept. I was a very, very hyperactive guy. Tremendous amount of explosive energy. Outlets is what I was looking for, and there was no outlets for this kind of energy, so drinking helped me calm it down because it was just too much, and a lot of it happened to be anger and a lot of issues that I had since I was a kid, which I've worked on these days, and I don't have that today, thank God. I feel content and comfortable in this skin. It's a good thing. Anyways, needless to say, put that aside, I think you have a picture of what kind of drinking went on and the violence and the insanity, because I lived next to a shooting gallery right in a crack village in Manhattan for 8 years. So I heard everything and saw everything over there, and more than I ever expected to see in my life. I thought a lot of that stuff was straight out of the movies. I lived right through it. I lived through it all. I reached Montreal 1991. The dates are foggy to this day. I have no idea. If it was 91, 92, I don't know when I got here. It must have been 91 because I worked around here because there was nobody in my family who wanted to know anything about me. And they were afraid of me. They had heard stories through the grapevine. This guy is not a healthy guy. He's not a very stable individual. He's not well up here. And he's a very, very dangerous man. That's what they had been told. So they didn't really want me. They gave me a little corner in the basement when I got out of the airport in Dorval. A little corner in the basement with a 2-week deadline to get the heck out of there. So what I did is I ended up from Manhattan to St. Jerome, a little town up north. A friend of mine opened up a restaurant up there, and I was in the restaurant business. I was born in it. I was peeling potatoes at 6 years old on Mount Royal. So I knew the restaurant business, so I went up there to St. Jerome, which was quite traumatic, actually, because you're coming out of Manhattan, which is like an asphalt jungle. To see the sun, you got to basically look up 90 degrees. And I ended up in St. Jerome, where there's nothing but sun. It felt like there was no cloak to hide under. It was unbelievable, and it was always daylight. But it didn't take long in St. Jerome. All of St. Jerome, this little village up here in the Laurentians, I think there's one dive in the whole place. I've been to a million of them in Manhattan, but in St. Jerome, there's one serious dive. The other places are really not so bad, but this one is not much bigger than three times the size of the kitchen. And it was dirty. And I would go in there, and it belonged to the Best Western Hotel. And I would go inside there, and I would drink every night after work. And it wasn't long that I was banned from that dive. I was thrown out of the dive, man. This was sickening. I said, this can't be. How could it be? I was not allowed into the dive. St. Jerome's only dive, and I wasn't allowed in it. Anyway, I didn't get along with the people I went up there with. So I had a friend of mine suggest at that time, who worked with me, he suggested that there was this opening up in the neighboring town called Lachute. To go over to Lachute. So I did. I went over to Lachute and I got this job, which was an excellent job. Like I told you, I've never really had a bad job. Everything I did was really good, very lucrative. I made lots and lots of money over there and I never saw a dime. Come payday, my boss would run and hide. And that's what really got to me. Because I had spent it during the week and payday, I couldn't get my pay and I wanted a loan for next week. To start, and I was off the next day, and this guy was running and hiding once he got on to me, and he realized what I did, that I was an alcoholic. But this little town, Lachute, is a tiny town. It's not much bigger than this church, and maybe a little main street. And I lived right on this little main street, upstairs in the hotel, and the restaurant was right here. It was just like a hop, skip, and a jump. I figured in this little town, What possible trouble can I possibly cause? What can I do in a little town like this, cause any kind of destruction or whatever? Anyway, he made me the manager of the place. So I managed 32 people, a staff. Within 7 days, they bought me a coffee cup, because everybody had their own coffee cup. Mine said Maniac. And they proudly presented me with this. And I proudly accepted. Thank you. Maniac. Everybody else has had a teddy bear or a butterfly or flowers. Mine had Maniac. So it didn't take them long in that little hick town to figure out exactly what they were dealing with. I lasted there for a year, like I said, and we nearly came to a serious gunfight at the OK Corral with that owner, whom in my mind I wanted dead. I couldn't stand this guy. I wanted him dead. He was calling me an alcoholic, and he had a brand new Volvo with all four corners hit. No lights. He had backed it into the corners. He would come into the shop, into the restaurant in the morning, start a little cognac, which never ended. And it would go on all day until he left. And then I found out later on he'd go home and brutalize his family. So he was a complete alcoholic, this guy too. However, this guy is the first guy who pointed out to me what my problem was. He says, "You're an alcoholic." I'm like, "What?" I thought he swore at me. "I'm an alcoholic. I'll take this knife and stab you with it. I'm an alcoholic." I thought he swore at me. He says, "I know what your problem is, Manny. I know what you need." And he came and he saw me and he brought me this the next day. The owner of the place. He brought me that book. Like Sean was saying before, if you want to hide something from an alcoholic, stick it in there. That's true. I looked at that book. I said, "This guy's real crazy." I said, "He's nuts if he thinks I'm going to..." First of all, I didn't have the concentration to be able to read something like that. That was way too complex, and that is a big book. Big book. I said, "No way am I looking into that. I'm into a sports page and comic books." So I propped up the slice machine and I was slicing smoked meat faster with that thing. That's exactly what I did with the book that he gave me, and that's exactly what I thought of that guy. However, that guy and I, we parted ways, and it was not very healthy. It was very bitter, the parting. I had some really strange ideas. This mind is very, very creative. And it could come up with creative things to do positive stuff and creative things, ways to do negative stuff. And it kept me up many, many a night thinking very negatively of this guy and how I could, you know, rid the world of such a disease or a plague. I must have had a higher power throughout all this. I believe strongly, strongly in the higher power. Had it not been for my higher power, I would not be standing here today. My second best prayer in the world is right up there. My higher power followed me from the beginning to the end. This power greater than myself saved my life, because the day I left Lachute, the weekend, it was a Friday. Saturday, Sunday came by, and then Monday morning, I was in the Montreal General Hospital. I don't know how. I have no idea who did it. I have no idea why I was standing in front of the Montreal General Hospital with two beers in my pocket, planning to drink my last two beers ever. I drank them and I went upstairs. I don't know how that happened. I really don't. Actually, today I do know. Then I had no idea, and I found out 2 years ago how it happened. My mother, who doesn't speak a single word of English, found the resources by telephone and had arranged for it. This lady, today's got Alzheimer's, dementia, she doesn't remember that she did it. I don't know how she did it. Nobody knows how she did it. Anyway, she had arranged for me to go into the Montreal General Hospital to get some kind of help. She didn't know where to reach. I guess somebody must have told her something. I don't know how it happened. She doesn't know how to explain it herself. I ended up in the psychiatric ward at the Montreal General Hospital, and that's where my journey of recovery begins. This was 1992, early 1992. They put me in the psychiatric ward there. It was a bit of a fiasco. If anybody's seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, this was like, you know, enhanced by 100 times. And I stayed there for 3 weeks in a private room. They didn't let me out onto the floor because it was, at the time, it was 5 East. Now they only have 4 East. It was a psychiatric ward. I'm saying, what am I doing in a psychiatric ward? I was wearing a robe with my butt was sticking out with paper slippers, and I was thinking of picturing myself again creatively running down Dr. Penfield. How long will these slippers last before they fall off my feet? How many steps will I take and then I'll be wearing nothing barefoot? I was trying to figure out if I put 3-4 pairs of these paper slippers, I can go further. I was trying to average the distance. And I stayed there 3 weeks. From there, they shipped me off to a treatment center in the South Shore. Everybody knows this place, Beaver, Foster, whatever they call it. And I stayed there for 6 weeks. So I managed to get close to 2 months of sobriety, straight in institutions. So I struggled to death to get that third month. I wanted that third month. I wanted that 3 month chip so badly, I can literally taste it. So I waited that month. It was an excruciating month. I got my 3 month chip and I went out and celebrated. It was a celebration for the ages. I mean, I was like done, toast. However, that treatment center, if it did nothing absolutely for me, which I think it didn't, there was too much thumb twiddling time, and it was a lot of waste of time over there. However, the one thing it did do is it introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous in the proper way. On Wednesday nights, they had a meeting there. We would have people from the outside coming in, and I was getting hugged, and I was like rigid and stiff as a board. I said, these people, they're hugging me. Oh, man. And I'd see the huggers come in and the friendly ones wanting with their hands. And I'd see these people walking in and they tried to always put me at the door to greet because they knew I didn't want to touch these people. You people. And some of them got to me. There was still a sense of decency left inside me. It hadn't all been snuffed out completely by the past experiences. Some of them got to me and kind of attracted me because they looked to me, being from Manhattan, straight out of Manhattan, they looked to me like they sold roses at the airport. All of them. These little dot was missing, but they all sold roses at some airport, or they were knocking on house doors and selling literature or something. I said to me, this is some kind of a cult. And I told my therapist there, this is a cult. He says, well, there's good cults and bad cults. He says, maybe this is a good cult, it'll do you good. I said, well, it didn't worry me too much. So I said, okay. But those people did get to me. They were really, really, really nice to somebody who was not very nice at that time. This was one of the first meetings I came to when I got out of there. I used to come over here. The meeting was set up this way. There was all candles and lights, but it was Tuesday beginners on Tuesday nights. I used to come here at the big church on St. Catherine, Sunday nighters, upstairs. I used to feel like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. I used to have all these experiences climbing up those stairs, going up to Sunday nighters. It used to be my sponsor's home group. In that place, I met my sponsor. This guy kept walking around like with a smile on his face, place to place, place to place. He piqued my curiosity, and I walked up to him and I told him, what are you so happy about? What the hell are you so happy about, man? What's your smile, man? Are you for real? Or are you just crazy? I know if you're walking down the streets more than 15 minutes with a smile on your face, the truck is going to come, strap you in a jacket, and take you down to the Douglas. That's not happy and joyous and free like we talk about. That's crazy. That's not well. So I saw this guy walking around every single week with a smile that I was there. So I stopped him. He did not become my sponsor at that time. Of course, I had a big ego and I was very, very clever. Eh? And I knew my way around and how to bob and weave around the social network, so to speak. So I came straight out of there and I got this guy with a briefcase and a three-piece suit to be my sponsor. This guy looked like the owner of AA. He was sitting up here all the time. I said, I'm going with the owner. This guy knows his stuff and I'm going with the big head honchos. The guy had 6 months of sobriety and he was not a well guy. Not a well guy. Actually, he's out somewhere now. I don't know what he's doing, this guy. I haven't heard of him in years. Anyway, I had a little bit of difficulties trying to find a sponsor, trying to find these home groups and things like that. I was very bitter. I was very angry. I would stand in the back of the rooms. I would never, never get up in front and speak, read, or anything. Somebody asked me to read something. What happened is when I stopped drinking, that old Manny came back. That little paralyzed, fearful Manny came back. The scariest thing of my life, it almost started me drinking again. I said, this is not real. This is not happening. I said, don't tell me I'm this terrified little kid in a 30-year-old man's body. And that's exactly how it was. That's what I went through. I experienced that full degree, to the fullest degree. There are times I even get nervous when I come up and speak in front of three people. There are times it doesn't bother me. It comes and goes. Today it just happens to be, I'm comfortable, fine. But that little guy came back. That fearful little guy, crippled little guy, was walking around the rooms acting constipated and angry at the same time. It was really, really crazy. It was a crazy time. My first 2 years in this program were very, very difficult. I had a difficult time. There's a lot of people I've heard who came to the revelation when they walked down the stairs, their obsession to drink left them and stayed outside. I congratulate those people. I'm not one of them. I'm definitely not one of them. My obsession to drink has not left me yet. It's still a possibility. Last year I was at a buffet and a friend of mine's wife turns around and says, Manny, I just can't believe what you told me about yourself. It's impossible you were that bad. And I spent the entire night, about 3 hours of that night, saying, I really wasn't that bad. Thirsty as hell. Thirsty as hell, with my Perrier in my hand and her champagne in hers, and I'm thinking to myself and her husband with a wine, I'm saying, you know, I think I can do it. I can't go as far back down as I did before. It's impossible, I say. I spent the entire night thirsty as can be. I went home and I had a nightmare that I drank. So I don't know about this obsession to drink leaving me. I don't believe there's such a thing as I'm a recovered alcoholic. That doesn't make sense to me. In my ears, that does not compute. I'm going to be recovering till the day I die. I'm an addict in every shape, every way you can possibly imagine. If I'm not addicted to alcohol, I'm addicted to working. If I'm not addicted to working, I'm addicted to eating. If I'm not addicted to eating, I'm addicted to golf. I find new addictions all the time. So if anybody's got any negative ones, keep them to yourself. Don't give me any ideas. I'm an addict and I'm going to stay that way for life. Other people may have recovered from this disease, but I'm never recovering from it. And that's for sure. This stays with me. Actually, it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing at all. I don't mind knowing that, because knowing that full well, I was addicted to video games. I spent an entire summer. I missed every single day of sunshine, July and August, playing a video game. A couple of years ago. So I could get addicted to anything that I like. There's no doubt about it. And I carry the whole slew of addictions that are recognizable today. So to me, an addict is an addict. That's why I find no difference between an alcoholic, a heroin addict, cocaine addict, a cigarette addict. They're all the same to me. Food addict. These are all the same. Sex addicts. They're all the same. An addiction is an addiction. I'm seeking a euphoric escape from my misery. That's all it was. That's all it is, and that's all it's ever going to be. At least for me. If it doesn't apply to you, congratulations. I never lost the obsession to drink. So I continued with these meetings. This program saved my life. It was not that therapy house or the psychiatric ward. However, I did do therapy. I stayed in therapy because the people who put me, that hospital who put me in that treatment center, I went back there and I did outpatient therapy there for years. They had to throw me out. Because I would come here, hear what's going on, talk with my sponsor, then validate it with my psychologist. And I needed that, my shrink, my psychiatrist, psychologist, therapist. I needed that kind of... I had to make sense of what was going on in this world. I didn't understand anything. I had complete zero people skills, social skills. I was a borderline savage. If you gave me a bow and arrow and threw me in the Amazon, I would have been perfect. Hunter-gatherer. I would have had my own tribe. That's exactly how I was. I barely understood the language. I barely knew what you people were talking. You people were talking, the big book was like rocket science. I could not understand. I didn't grasp this concept. It was impossible for me to be able to stay and live a normal life out here. I should have been put in a cage. I would have lived much easier in my own head. So I had to start from scratch, and I needed a lot more help than most people do, I guess. I don't know. But this worked for me. I'm not the AA spokesman, and I'm not speaking on behalf of AA here. I'm speaking on behalf of Manny and how I got sober. And what I needed to do, whatever I needed to do, I did for myself. I went out there, and I'm a proactive type of guy. I'm not the type of guy who sits back. I need help, I go seek it. I go get it. I find it, I track it down, and I pinpoint the bullseye, and I go for it. I do not stop, and nothing stops me from it. What I found was that the longer I stayed sober, the better I started feeling. Because I guess that 6-year-old fearful little kid and the 30-year-old man, the mental age started to catch up with the chronological age a lot faster than had I been 6 and started the whole thing all over again. That would have been a problem. I'd probably be a 6-year-old alky or who knows what. However, I started to feel better. I started to do better. I started to start to live a little better. I started to make a couple of friends here and there. It's not that I was an unpopular guy or a very lonely guy. Wherever I drank, I knew everybody everywhere. Daytime, nighttime, I always had a crowd of people around me. I was not a person that didn't have the skills, but I only had them when I drank. When I didn't drink, I didn't like anybody around me. I didn't have the skills. One of the scariest things in the entire planet for me was not to go with and walk into the dead darkness of Manhattan's Harlem at 3 in the morning. That didn't scare me. What scared me was the normal person who's feeling good and has a smile on their face asks me to go to Tim Hortons for a coffee. That terrified me. That was the biggest terror in the whole world. Tim Hortons for a coffee? What the hell do they want? Tim Hortons for a coffee? I used to walk by Tim Hortons and look inside, and I used to think that they were planning what they're going to do that night. I said, they can't be in there for coffee. That's not normal. I used to find that as abnormal behavior. So I was scared of the normal things, which people just live that way. I was scared of the normal stuff. The abnormal stuff did not scare me. And there is where my mind used to twist. Nevertheless, I stayed in this program and I stuck with it because there was really no other way. There was no way out. So I did a lot of that. Sponsor I got was a really, really good sponsor. That guy saved me. He helped me. He didn't save me. I saved myself. I did all the work myself. I did the steps. I joined a home group. I had a home group for 7 years. I did the 12-step rep, the GSR. I did the whole ordeal, you know, the chairs, the ashtrays. Back then we had ashtrays. And the sweeping of the floors. I did whatever I could. I kind of jumped in he made me jump into this program head first. And that's exactly what I did. I don't do the same things I used to do back then. I'm a little bit busier today. I don't do as many meetings as I'd like to do at times when I get really busy. But when I have time on my hands, like I have had recently, I just increase the amount of meetings I do. It makes me feel good. I feel at home here. It doesn't bother me at all. There are other places I still don't feel that at home. While I was doing all these meetings and I was a part of 25 different groups, every meeting I went to, I signed and I joined. I didn't know better, so I joined every group. So I had to do coffee and secretary and ashtrays and clear and sandwiches and cookie details. 25 different meetings. I had to buy an agenda. I could not remember what I had to do. I had an agenda. I'm doing this. I was running around like a madman for 2 years. Like a madman. I was as nuts then as I was when I was drinking. And I told my sponsor one day, I tell him, you know, I do all this work for AA and they don't pay me a dime. There's no money to be made in this AA. I'm used to making money. I said, they should pay me. They should do something. He told me to shut up and go and do some volunteer work. Volunteer work? I said, where I come from, we're against that. We don't believe in that. And I went and I did some volunteer work. I worked at the West Island Volunteer Bureau. I was taking old people to hospital appointments. It was probably the greatest job I've ever done. And then what happened is after that job, I did 14 years of volunteer work, straight, nonstop. I worked in every hospital and institution in this island, on the island of Montreal and out. Volunteer work is the greatest work anybody could ever do if you have difficulties with your esteem like I did and still do at times. Every time I'd walk in the place, they'd just want to hug me and kiss me because I was there to help. There was no charge. The people that were there were absolutely astounded that I was there in the first place, actually helping them for no reason, no pay, for nothing. I got kind of addicted to volunteer work. 14 years of it. And then the addiction had to stop because I got tired. It was exhausting. At the same time as I did the volunteer work, I decided to go back and somebody suggested go and get your high school diploma. Because I never did. I went and I got my high school diploma. And from there I met this friend. She had kaleidoscope blue eyes. I remember looking into her eyes and she told me, you know, you should come with me, Manny. I'm so happy she said what she said because she could have said anything and I would have said yes. Right now, I'd be up in Nepal in the mountains, shaved head, and I'd be a monk. If she decided, let's go to Tibet. Good idea, I would have said. She said, come with me to university. University? What the hell is that? Come with me to university. She said, listen, on the phone, it gave her a mark for intro to some kind of psychological program. She got an A-. She says, you see, I'm going to university. I said, what are you doing here in high school if you're in university? She says, I have to finish this to continue there. So she said, university? Me, I said, that's fine. I had no intention of school. That was not what was on my mind. I just wanted to be with her. So I decided to follow her to university. And she was an independent student. I made an application and they accepted me immediately in the Faculty of Psychology. So I finished my high school and I did a bachelor's degree in psychology at Concordia University. And that's where I worked in the Center for Behavioral Neurobiology, and I published a thesis on addiction. I was injecting animals with different types of drugs. And that's where anonymity comes in, very, very important for those of you who are think that it's a very mild or light statement. I would second guess that that type of thinking. I did not tell anybody. My first year I was excited to be in university. I told everybody I was an alcoholic. Thank God they all dropped out. None of them had the stamina to stay. Because in my later years, I was in charge in the Center for Behavioral Neurobiology for 3 years of a drug store. Of all the confiscated drugs in the city, this whole wall was full of bricks of any drug you liked. We used to shave the bricks and inject it into rats. And there was chunks of the stuff on the floor, and the lab was 24 hours a day, and there was footprints on the stuff. What was on the floor was worth millions out on the street. Had anybody known my story, they would have probably thought, because there was always drugs missing. And there was a lot of people in that laboratory. We were there day and night, and they were walking around with these giant eyes and gloves. You knew. I knew. I don't know what they knew, but I knew. And there was always drugs missing. They would have all blamed them on the alky. So it was very, very wise of me to keep my mouth shut at that time. I graduated from Concordia University, and then I went over to McGill, and I did a master's degree in psychology, and I did my all my coursework for the PhD. I'm a doctoral candidate. And today I'm a psychologist, the Order of Psychologists of Quebec, and that's how I make my living. Life has turned kind of like a fairy tale, a storybook, whatever you want to call it. I have a very, very good life. I'm really, really lucky. I don't know where I found the energy. I told you I'm a very energetic guy. Not today as much as I was back then. But I did it exactly the way I did AA. How I did it, AA helped me. I took a course in the morning, a meeting at lunchtime, and a course in the afternoon. That's how I got through my bachelor's degree. And AA played an instrumental role in my ability to do the things I did. I don't even know how I did it. When people say today, I understand these old-timers today who say it, because I didn't understand it back then, when they say I definitely have another drunk inside me, but I don't know if I have another recovery inside me, I understand why they say that. Because I can never do what I've done, ever again. So if I was to relapse today, I don't think you'd ever see me again. So I have a definite fear of this relapse business. And it always scares me, and I'm always on guard. When I go to a party or anything, I carry my water with my lid on it, and if I ever lose sight of it, I go get another one. So this program has saved my life, and it's given me a life that I could only have imagined. I couldn't even have imagined this. A movie couldn't play out this, that I would actually believe if I was watching it. I'd say this is a fairy tale. Today, I can actually tell you, I'm not only content, and I have some esteem, and I don't carry those fearful ghosts anymore. I'm not afraid of the dark. I'm afraid of an airplane crashing or falling off a building, realistically. But I'm not afraid of being in a dark place or being of ghosts that are created in this mind. No, that nonsense is gone. I'm comfortable in my own skin. What you see is what you get. This is me. I don't try to be anybody else. My real wish was just to become real and be myself. And that's who I'm still working on, and I'm pretty good. I'm doing pretty good with it because I'm feeling pretty good about myself. And I probably am the happiest guy I know, where I was the most miserable in the whole world. I never experienced a day of happiness until I came into these rooms. And since I've been in these rooms, slowly but surely, stacking one day at a time, today I am probably the happiest guy I know, and I wish the same to each and every one of you. Thank you.